Chapter 98. The English Church in the 17th Century. We will at this time again cast a glance at England. Queen Elizabeth had died there in 1603. This monarch, about whom we told you in Chapter 85, had never been married, so that she died childless. For that reason, there was no successor to the English throne. Yet there was. James I reigned in Scotland. He was the son of Mary Stuart, the Queen of Scotland. We still know who she was, do we not? She was the zealous Roman Catholic queen who reigned over Scotland when John Knox carried through the Reformation in that country. Due to her wicked conduct in life and her enmity toward the Reformation, she had to leave Scotland. At that time, she fled to her cousin Elizabeth, the Queen of England, did she not? However, Elizabeth had her arrested and finally killed because Mary Stuart plotted against her with the object to push her off the throne. After her death, her son, James I, became King of Scotland. Well then, when in 1603 Elizabeth died, this James I became King of England and Scotland at the same time. Hence, from that moment, those two separate kingdoms became united into one kingdom. The Roman Catholics rejoiced. They were firmly convinced that James would choose their side. Naturally, that could be no different. Was he not the son of the zealous Roman Catholic Mary Stuart? Now the Roman Catholic Church would become supreme again in England and Scotland. But the Roman Catholics made a mistake. The king supported the Anglican Church. In the beginning of Chapter 85, we told you about the Anglican Church. At that time, Henry VIII, the English monarch, when he could not have his own way, disengaged the English Roman Catholic Church from the Pope, had he not? But that did not mean that the Anglican Church had also disengaged itself entirely from the doctrine of the Roman Catholic Church. Oh no, many things remained as they were. Some things were changed. For that reason, the English State Church was half Roman Catholic and half Protestant. The king had become the head of that English State Church. And lo, that was just the thing the new English king James I wanted. He was the king who must reign not only over the state, but also over the church. It had to be done as it pleased him. He was proud and ambitious, and for that reason he supported the Anglican State Church. Although at first the Roman Catholics were not persecuted by him, yet that which they had hoped for did not happen. The Pope of Rome had nothing to say in the Anglican State Church, and thus it remained. He, James I, the king, would stipulate how the church had to be ruled. For that reason, the Roman Catholics were so disappointed. The Jesuits, who had also hoped that the Roman Catholic Church would become supreme again, incited the Roman Catholic nobles. They would take vengeance upon the king, a terrible and abominable vengeance. The large Parliament building stood in London. In our country, we have the House of Congress and the Senate. Well, then, in England, they call that the Parliament. Naturally, the building in which Parliament met was called the Parliament Building. Large basements were built beneath that building. They were rented out as warehouses. the embittered Roman Catholic noblemen with the Jesuits devised a devilish plan. One of those Roman Catholic noblemen, as a so-called merchant, rented a warehouse beneath that Parliament building. One day, many boxes and vats were carried into that warehouse. All that was very customary. That merchant stored his wares in that warehouse. Naturally, no one saw anything uncommon in that, because had not that merchant rented that warehouse for that? Above those cellars were the spacious assembly halls in which the English Parliament assembled. On the 5th of November, 1605, the Parliament meets again. Probably for the first time, the King shall also attend that meeting. Stately and dignified, the members of Parliament enter and take their seats. There is laughing and talking because the meeting has not yet been opened. A few members are conversing socially at the tall windows. The King also enters, and then all sit down. No one is aware that they are in peril of death. In peril of death? Why? There is nothing unusual to be seen. Everything outside is quiet. And yet it is true, because under them, in the cellars, stand the vats and the boxes which have been brought in by the Roman Catholic noblemen. However, those boxes are not filled with merchandise, but with gunpowder. But the King and the members of Parliament do not know that. The gentlemen are quietly assembled together. The Roman Catholics have cunningly applied a fuse leading to that piled-up gunpowder, and that fuse has already been ignited. Gradually, that little flame smolders further. The fire draws closer to the vats with their deadly contents. Yet a few moments, then the fire shall reach the powder, and then a terrible explosion shall cause London to shake upon its foundations. Then the Parliament building shall fly in the air, and all the members of Parliament and the King shall be killed and lie mutilated under the debris. Then tens, perhaps hundreds of innocent citizens in the immediate vicinity shall likewise be killed. Then harmless children shall be torn to pieces. Behold, that was the devilish plan of the Jesuits. Slowly, the fuse burns further in the dark cellar. Inch after inch is consumed. However, one of the conspirators feels that it has gone too far. At the last moment, he betrays the secret. Hastily, some employees run down to the cellar. It is a great risk, because no one knows how far that fuse has burned. However, it concerns their life. They kick in the door, and the fuse is stamped out. Just in time, half a minute later, and it would have been too late. A sigh of relief is heard. The meeting is immediately adjourned, because first those perilous vats and boxes must be removed. In the nick of time, the entire government and the King have escaped death. The conspirators are seized and all put to death. But the real guilty ones, the Jesuits, remained for the greater part out of range. From that time on, the enmity toward the Roman Catholics was great, and that was no wonder. They had only to thank themselves for that. Here we see again the devilish cruelty of the Jesuits. Every expedient to achieve their object was permissible. did not matter, even though it should cost streams of blood. In history, this attempt is known as the Gunpowder Plot. Not only the Roman Catholics, but also the Protestants were pushed in the background. We already know that the Protestants in England were called Puritans, and the Protestants in Scotland were called Presbyterians. The English Puritans and the Scottish Presbyterians did not agree with the Anglican Church. That English state church was too much as the Roman Catholics to suit them. For that reason, they separated themselves from the Anglican Church and met in ordinary homes. However, that was not to the liking of James I. Forcefully, he introduced the Anglican State Church in Scotland. Had not England and Scotland become one kingdom? Well then, unity must also prevail in ecclesiastical sphere. Oh, if he had been able, then the king would have destroyed the work of John Knox in Scotland. Then the Reformation in Scotland would have perished. But God watched over his church, because that which happened in Scotland had been his work. The opposition was enormous, which the king experienced in Scotland. The Scotch Presbyterians were severely persecuted, but they persevered. That enmity of James I against the Presbyterians existed already when he ruled only over Scotland, and when in 1603 he became king also of England, then the English Puritans feared the worst. The king would treat them the same as he did the Scotch Presbyterians. Do you know what? They shall kindly ask the king if he will not persecute them. They draw up a petition. That petition is signed by thousands of English Puritans. After that, it is solemnly presented to the king. They had something like that in the Netherlands too, didn't they? Just think of the petition of the nobles, which had been presented to the governess, Margaret of Parma. Well then, something like that happened also in England. The Puritans hoped that it would help. They hoped that the king would consider them, and that they would be spared the lot of the Scotch Presbyterians. But they were sadly disappointed. It was of no avail. The king became angry when he noticed that he was being thwarted in his plans. He demanded that the English Puritans would submit themselves. They had to return to the English state church of which he was the head. They were mocked and put in the background. They were persecuted and oppressed. All government positions remained closed to them. In their business, they were opposed in every way. It is therefore no wonder that the Puritans became discouraged. Many of them left the country and went as emigrants to America in order in that way to escape the persecution. Much could be told about this. How much have those exiles, for that is what they really were, suffered? Also, that misery cannot be described with a pen. But, however nice or rather sad those narratives might be, we cannot discuss everything because then we would never get done. Just bear in mind that also through this, the gospel has come to America. God's ways are higher than our ways. God alone knows how many in America, through their coming, have been eternally saved. Ultimately, all things must work together for good. During the reign of James I, It did not go well in England and Scotland. The greatest part of the English inhabitants were Puritans. Because of this, Sunday in England was observed as the day of the Lord. All labor was stopped on that day. But James I, their king, laughed at that Puritan sanctifying of Sunday. All sorts of wicked feasts and amusements were introduced by the king just on Sunday. This he did purposely. Through that, the enmity and the resistance of the English and Scotch people increased against the king. No, they were not happy with James I. In 1625, the king died. Shall it now become better? A new king ascended the English throne. His name was Charles I, and he was a son of James I. Those who had secretly hoped that now it would become better were sadly disappointed in their expectations. It did not become better, but worse. Charles I was married to a Roman Catholic princess. She came from France, and she was the daughter of Henry IV, the former leader of the Huguenots. In chapter 83, we told you already that this Henry IV, in order to become king, became Roman Catholic again. Hence, he was an apostate. Well then, the English king, Charles I, became his son-in-law. Charles I has tried his entire life to make the Anglican Church, hence the English State Church, Roman Catholic again. We told you just now that the greatest part of the English people were Puritans. For that reason, the English people vehemently resisted the attempts of their monarch. The king and the majority of the people became enemies of each other. Also, the English government, the Parliament, did not agree with the actions of Charles I. But then the king sent the administrators home, and henceforth he ruled without the Parliament. He would determine how England had to be ruled. He did not need the assistance and the support of the people for that. Since Charles I, just as his father was also King of Scotland, he tried with force to establish the Anglican Church in Scotland. His father had tried that too, isn't that so? But we already know Scotland was Presbyterian. There, at the time of John Knox, about whom we told you in chapters 86 and 87, the Reformation was carried through. Also in Scotland, a violent resistance developed against the plans of the king. The Scots did not want the half-Roman Catholic and half-Protestant Anglican Church. In February 1638, a tremendous commotion prevailed near the Scottish city of Edinburgh. From all parts of the country, the Scots have traveled to that city, and more are continually coming. Finally, more than 60,000 people are there together. Addresses were made wherein the seriousness of the state of affairs was pointed out, because if Charles I got his way, then the Reformation work of John Knox would be to a great extent destroyed. One of the Scottish leaders offered prayer, in which he asked the Lord for his blessing upon that which would take place. At that immense meeting, the Scots concluded an alliance called the Covenant. Something like that had taken place before in Scotland. We told you about that in chapter 87. Then the Scottish nobles made a covenant to protect the persecuted and oppressed congregations against the attacks of the Roman Catholic Church. Now, in 1638, outside of Edinburgh, another covenant is made. But now it was not only the nobles, but the people were also included in it. An article was drawn up and was signed by all. That signing lasted for many hours. One wrote beside his name, "Unto death." Another signed his name with his own blood. This covenant was not directly against Rome, but against the introduction of the Anglican Church with all its Roman Catholic remains. The king did not care a bit about all this, but he would still carry through his will. The result was that the Scottish people took up arms and rebelled. Charles I sent an army to Scotland to compel them by force, but that army was defeated, and the imperial soldiers were driven out of Scotland. All Anglican novelties, which had been introduced by the king and his assistants, were at the same time abolished. Charles I tried once more to subdue the unruly Scots. The troops of Charles were defeated the second time and driven away. The resistance also increased in England, and the opposition against the ambition for power of Charles I grew more and more. In England, as well as in Scotland, the alienation between king and subjects became ever greater. Besides, something terrible happened in Ireland. The Irish people were predominantly Roman Catholic, but neither did the English dynasty consider that. Instead of bringing the gospel to Ireland, instead of sending missionaries to endeavor to draw the Irish people out of the darkness of Rome, the Anglican Church was forcefully introduced into Ireland by the English kings. Besides, the Irish were being oppressed. Many English nobles obtained large tracts of land in Ireland, while the inhabitants themselves lived in the most bitter poverty. Hence, it is no wonder that the Irish people became filled with bitterness toward the English squires. These squires lived in great luxury and excess, while the peasants and their families suffered hunger. From time to time, the English landowners had great hunting feasts. Then the fields of the poor Irish farmer were trampled down. Now Charles I reigned. He gradually tried to make the English state church Roman Catholic. The Irish thought, "Ah, the king's on our side. The king shall surely help us." And they revolted. The long pent-up hatred burst loose in all its violence. The Irish took vengeance, bloody vengeance, upon the English squires. More than 12,000 English Protestants who lived in Ireland were cruelly murdered. This massacre is at times called Irish St. Bartholomew Night. When the report of that penetrated into England, and then the dismay and indignation was great. The king was blamed for that. In 1642, a civil war broke out in England itself. Oliver Cromwell became the leader of the English Puritans. He was the son of an English squire, and he had been brought up as a strict Puritan. Well, then, this Cromwell assembled an army from among the English peasants, And while singing psalms, this army marched to fight against the imperial soldiers. Twice in succession, the troops of Charles I were defeated. The king, who through that got into great difficulties, fled to Scotland. But the Scottish government arrested him. He was allowed to remain in Scotland, but then he must sign the covenant. That was the Scottish covenant, which we just told you about, isn't that so? However, Charles I refused to sign that covenant. Thereupon, the Scottish administration extradited the king to the English Parliament. To be brief, the end of it all was that in 1649, Charles I was beheaded upon the scaffold. Thus terminated the life of this foolish king, who at all costs wanted to assert his will and who would not listen to good advice. England was now no longer a kingdom, but it became a republic. Oliver Cromwell became head of this English republic, and who, by his victories over Charles I, had obtained great influence. Oliver Cromwell has ruled England with a firm hand. He has been the deliverer of the English Protestants. During his reign, the Protestant churches in England and Scotland finally obtained rest. I purposely wrote churches because the English Puritans were divided into various groups who all had a separate name. But if we should treat those groups separately, then we would never get done, and it would also become too difficult and too complicated. For that reason, we shall continue to mention them by the collective name of Puritans. The Anglican Church was put in the background. Thousands of Anglican clergymen were dismissed from their office and were no longer permitted to preach. Yet they were not altogether reduced to beggary, because they were permitted to retain a fifth part of their salary, of their earnings. Oliver Cromwell did not reign very long. He died already in 1658. 2 years later, England became a kingdom again. The beheaded king, Charles I, had a son, Charles II. During the reign of Cromwell, this Charles had fled from the country and lived in Breda, thus in the Netherlands. That happened because his sister, Mary Stuart, was married with Stadtholder William II. Well then, in 1660, a few English noblemen came to Breda, and they kindly asked Charles II if he would return to England to become king. Naturally, Charles II immediately complied with that request. When he rode into London, the people applauded him enthusiastically, and not long after that, he was solemnly crowned as king. One of the first measures which that new king took was the re-establishment of the Anglican Church. The Anglican clergymen, who during the reign of Cromwell had been dismissed, were immediately restored into their office. They, in turn, took vengeance upon the Puritans. More than 2,000 Puritan preachers were put out of their official work and dispelled. Those Puritan preachers were reduced to beggary, because they no longer received anything, and with their families they were plunged into the greatest misery and poverty. However, it did not remain with that. A terrible persecution broke loose against the Puritans, and many landed in prison. What a change! The Anglican Church triumphed. Do you know who was also made prisoner and was put in a cell? The well-known John Bunyan. You have heard that name mentioned at times, have you not? He did not belong to the rich and prominent citizens. No. His father was a tinker, and with hard work he earned a scanty livelihood. Although John was allowed to go to the village school where he learned to read and to write, yet there was no money for further study. He was trained in the same trade as his father, and thus he would also become a tinker. He was rough and careless, and lived in the midst of the world. Some writers tell us that when things did not go to his liking, he would swear terribly. If that is true, then he had trouble enough about that later on. But what happened? He married a very poor girl who brought only a few edifying books with her. That was all. Thus, he continued to live in sin until God converted him and called a halt to him. Then his wicked life returned to him. What a heavy strife of soul he had to wrestle through. Many times he was despondent. Then he thought that he could not be saved, that he had sinned too great and too much. Often he was afraid that he had committed the sin against the Holy Spirit. We know that the sin against the Holy Spirit is unpardonable. To those people, the door of grace is shut forever here upon earth already. John Bunyan was also attacked with that fear. Then the cold sweat came over him. Then he trembled when he reflected upon the time when day after day he blasphemed and dishonored God's holy name. He has also experienced that we do not sin cheaply. Then the devil whispered to him, "Put an end to it." The Prince of Darkness tried to tempt him with suicide. The infernal agony of soul wore him out bodily. But it did not remain that way. It could not remain that way. Also, Bunyan has found forgiveness of his many sins in the blood of the Lord Jesus. That has been something to Bunyan when he experienced the debt-atoning power of that sacrifice in his soul. Bunyan has learned what grace signifies. It is self-evident that all this caused an entire change in his life. It is true his work continued to claim him because that had to go on. Daily he traveled from one farm to another, and in that way he earned a living for himself and his family. However, he could not be silent about what had happened in his life. In that way, he preached at the farms or wherever he worked. He directed those plain people to the way of salvation. Who could speak better about that than he? Had he not been saved as an ungodly one? Later, he appeared as preacher at meetings. And preach? That he could. The Lord had granted him great gifts. Whenever it became known that Bunyan would preach, then from far and near hundreds, yea, thousands of people flocked together. Breathlessly they listened to his serious and yet glowing words. The learned and God-fearing Owen said of him at one time, "I would gladly give all my learning if I could preach like him." In 1660, he was arrested because he preached without a license. They locked him up in prison, and he spent 12 years in the dungeon. That has been something for him, because as a tinker, he was used to liberty and the open air. However, now and then the keeper allowed him to leave the prison for a while. Then he was permitted to visit his wife and children. But naturally, he had to promise that he would return. Otherwise, the keeper himself would get into trouble. We see also in this that the Lord inclines the hearts. After such a brief leave of absence, he returned voluntarily back to prison. Yet he did not spend that time in idleness, because he wrote various books, which later have been read by millions of people and are still being read. Well known is his book, The Holy War. Do you know that book? No? Then you must read that once. In 1672, he was discharged from prison. 3 years later, he was locked up again, and again he spent several months in prison. During that time, he has written that world-famous and everywhere known little book, Pilgrim's Progress. You know that book, don't you? That little book has been a blessing to many. How wonderful are the ways of God, are they not? If he had not been locked up in prison, then perhaps he would not have had the time for that. Now his books still serve God's church. He died in 1688. The occasion to his death was the following. A father and his son had a severe quarrel with each other. When Bunyan heard that, he saddled his horse and went there. He would try and get those two reconciled. Indeed, he was really successful in getting that father and son reconciled with each other. Cheerfully, Bunyan returned home. In pouring rain, he hastened to his wife and children. On that journey, he caught a bad cold. That became his death. He departed in peace. Of him it may be said, the memory of the just is blessed. Indeed, in England and in Scotland, many preachers have lived, devout men who have written good books. Those sermons are still being read in many churches where there are no ministers. I shall mention a few of those preachers. Who has never yet heard of the Erskines, and of Boston, and of Gray, and of Owen? There are many more, but I shall not mention any more. How sad it is that hundreds of boys and girls do not even know the names, not to mention the works which they wrote. Who of you is able to mention 5 additional names, besides the old writers which I have just mentioned? Who? If I asked for the names of 5 baseball players, or of 5 film stars, then perhaps I would receive more correct answers to this question. Isn't that at times true? How sad are the times in which we are living. The life and the works of those men have been a blessing for many, and God's children are still being edified by those works. Nowadays, many seem to consider it a disgrace to read old writers. How much could be told about these people? However, it would carry us too far if we had to tell the life histories of these devout men. We have treated one briefly, namely John Bunyan. During the reign of Charles II, the Puritans in England did not have it very easy. Charles II was really Roman Catholic at heart, and his aim was to gradually make England Roman Catholic again. He favored the Roman Catholics in all possible ways. If he had been able to get his way, then, But the English Parliament checked that. The administration maintained the Anglican Church. In 1673, a new law was passed in England. The name of that law was Test Act. In that law, it was written that no one was permitted to occupy a seat in the government, or he must take an oath upon the state church, and that state church was the Anglican Church. Members of the government were obliged to take communion in the state church. Besides, various things were written in that Test Act which were directed against the Roman Catholics. The Roman Catholic doctrine of transubstantiation was forbidden. The worship of saints was also opposed. We all realize very well that this law was not to the liking of the king, but he could do nothing about that. From all this, it is clear that the Roman Catholics and the Puritans stood outside. They could not take part in the government of the country. Yea, worse, they were even persecuted and often locked up in prison. And even though the stakes did not smoke, as in the days of the Inquisition, their position was far from easy. They were constantly slighted. Because the actions and the decisions of the Parliament did not suit Charles II, strained relations continued to exist between the king and the administration. In 1685, Charles II died suddenly. He had no children who could succeed him. For that reason, his brother, James II, became king in his place. How shall it go now? It is 3 years later. A small ship, upon which a few prominent English gentlemen are found, who are on the way to Holland, sails over the turbulent waves of the North Sea. Their faces look serious and alarmed. From everything it is apparent that it is no pleasure trip. Indeed, it is no pleasure trip. Look, there they step on shore in Holland, and immediately they proceed toward the palace of Stadtholder William III. On behalf of the greatest part of the English people, they ask him if he will come over to England to help them. To help? Why? Was that necessary? Yes, that was highly necessary, because things did not go well in England. No, things did not go right at all. Protestantism was in mortal danger in England. For that reason, those English gentlemen were so downhearted. James II, the new king, was a zealous Roman Catholic. Besides, he was married to a Roman Catholic princess. His life's object was to destroy Protestantism in England and to fully restore the Roman Catholic Church. The Roman Catholics were jubilant. They had looked forward to that for so long already. Various Jesuits had already settled themselves in London. They would help the king and advise him how he must achieve his object. One of his first acts was to suspend the Test Act. We just told you what was written in that law, did we not? If anyone wanted to get into the government, then he had to take an oath upon the state church. That applied to the Roman Catholics, too. Well then, said James II, that is no longer necessary. We all realize what the object of that was, do we not? It was not the object of James II to get the Puritans into the government, but the Roman Catholics. England had to become Roman Catholic again. To achieve that, he had made a secret alliance with Louis XIV, the ardent Roman Catholic king of France. We still know who that was, do we not? We have told you in detail about that in chapter 84. The city of Oxford is situated close to London, the capital of England. For centuries already, a famous university was situated there. John Wycliffe had studied there. That was already a long time ago. And now James II wanted to make a Roman Catholic college of that famous university. At the cost of everything, the Roman Catholic Church had to become supreme again in England. Now you realize that Protestantism was threatened with destruction. In that great distress, the Anglican Church and the Puritans began to cooperate. As a consequence of that, the opposition against the plans of the king became ever stronger. There was still a bright speck for the Protestants. James II had no son who could succeed him. He did have daughters. The name of his oldest daughter was Mary Stuart. Hence, she was the crown princess, and this Mary was the wife of Stadtholder William III. Now, the Protestants hoped secretly that James II, who was no longer young, would one day be succeeded by his daughter. If that happened, then the threatening danger would be averted. However, something happened suddenly which dashed this hope to pieces. While no one reckoned on it anymore, a little prince was born in the royal palace. Some writers claim that this little prince was no son at all of James II, but a strange child which had been adopted by the king. Whether that was true, we cannot say with certainty. However, that may be, that was a sad disappointment to the Protestants. Being at their wits' end, they decided to ask the help of William III, the Dutch stadtholder. He was the son-in-law of James II, was he not? Naturally, it would not be easy for William III to come actively to the aid of the English Protestantism, because then he would have to join battle against the father of his wife. And the great question was, shall Mary give her approval to that? And really, James II was her father. Much would depend on how Mary Stuart stood over against that. If she was opposed to that, then it would be doubly difficult for her husband, William III, to interfere in that strife. Shall the English gentleman be successful? We hope to tell you about that in the next chapter.